Okay, so we have heard from during previous talks that have reviewed what is our current understanding of the process of primordial star formation and what are the theoretical expectations for the characteristic masses of the first stars. And we know that these characteristic masses generally vary between 30 to 300 solar masses, depending on many different feedback processes that we have already heard this morning on. But we also know from the observations of present-day star-forming regions that the stars today form according to a Salpira EMF with a characteristic mass of one solar mass. So this clearly points seems to indicate that there must have been a transition in the properties of star formation during cosmic evolution, and we believe that this transition is really very much related to the degree of metal enrichment of the star-forming gas. So this is the outline of my talk. I will first try to review what are the physical concepts about this critical metallicity for low-mass star formation and how we can place some limits on this critical parameter. Then I will address the issue of the cosmic relevance of population tree stars, which is deeply related to the strength of the chemical feedback, and it has also strong implications for the cosmic star formation history and the history of reionization, and how we can have already some good insights on the physics of the transition from present observations, and also how can we have a measure of the strength of chemical feedback looking at the spectra of distant quasars. So we have already heard part of it this morning, but we know that the metallicity affects the stellar mass scales in two ways. First, it alters the thermal evolution of pre-stellar clouds, therefore affecting the typical fragmentation scale. And second, in sufficiently metal-enriched regions, we expect that the accretion process will be limited or halted by the radiation force exerted on dust grains. And we know from published studies that this the first aspect has been parametrized with the so-called critical metallicities, and different studies have given different ranges for these critical metallicities, which the difference mainly depend on the degree of input physics that you consider in the thermal evolution of the pre-stellar clouds. And more recently, Brohm and Loeb have distinguished among different coolants, and they end up with these two critical values for the oxygen and carbon abundances, which are the main coolants in the gas phase in metal-enriched regions. The second process starts to be interesting in inhibiting the accretion at a somehow larger value of the metallicity. So we believe that it is the first one which defines the stellar mass scales, because it is the first one which occurs in the course of metal enrichment. And we can have a good insight of what is the typical fragmentation scales using thermal physics within the standard Jeans mass criterion. But in order to do that, you really have to follow the thermal and chemical evolution of pre-stellar clouds in a highly accurate way, because the Jeans mass depends very much on the temperature. So this can be accomplished rather easily with one-zone semi-analytic model, and we have views, the model developed originally by Kazuo Mukai, which considers more than 40 different cooling agents with more than 400 chemical reactions, and we have analyzed what is the pre-stellar evolution as a function of the initial metallicity of the gas. So here I show the thermal evolution of the pre-stellar clouds as a function of the central density. So this diagram can be read as a time sequence as the pre-stellar clouds proceed in their collapse. And in the bottom panel, I show the corresponding evolution of the adiabatic index, and the different curves correspond to different initial values of metallicities, going from 0 to 10 to minus 6 solar, 10 to minus 4 solar, 10 to minus 2 solar, and solar. The first two lines are degenerate in the upper panel. So what you see here is that cooling and fragmentation stops when the relatively high densities, as we have already heard this morning, because of the properties of molecular hydrogen, and the corresponding fragment mass is very high, is of order of 10 to the 3 solar masses. However, as the metallicity, from this point on, the fragment starts to collapse until a central core is formed, which quickly accretes matter from the surrounding envelope. Now, as the metallicity of the gas is increased to 10 to minus 4 or above, what you see is that there is a new phase of cooling and fragmentation at much higher densities, which is induced mainly by the presence of metals in solid dust grains. So it is this phase which actually is responsible for leading to a strong transition in the fragmentation scales, and which occurs at a critical metallicities ranging between 10 to minus 6 to 10 to minus 4 solar. To better understand this point, we have rerun the code, but this time we have fixed the initial metallicity of the gas to be 10 to minus 5 solar, which is at the center of the critical range, and we have followed the evolution, this time varying the dust depletion factors, that means the total dust mass relative to the total mass in metals. Again, what you see is that fragmentation stops at relatively high densities with correspondingly high fragment masses if the depletion factor is less than 20%. But as the depletion factor gets to this value, again, you have the activation of the fragmentation process at much higher densities because of the cooling of dust grains. So the bottom line here is that you can form low-mass fragments even at the critical metallicities if the depletion factor is larger than a critical value, which of course depends on the metallicity of the pre-stellar clouds. And it's 1 for metallicities lower than 10 to minus 6, meaning that you cannot rely on this process and you will form only large fragments, and decreases for increasing metallicities. So, but what I want to leave you with is that dust grains are really very important to understand low mass fragmentation at the lowest metallicities. Now, so far, all the analysis has relied on the assumption that the different metal abundances and the properties of dust are the same as those observed in present-day interstellar gas. This is, of course, likely to be violated in the early universe, and it is very important to make a self-consistent analysis, taking into consideration the metal yields and the dust properties produced by the first supernovae. And we know that dust is indeed produced in supernova explosions about 100, 200 days after the explosions. Conditions occur in the ejecta for dust, for metals in the gas phase to condense in solid dust grains. And I show here the results for perinstability supernovae and for core collapse type 2 supernovae as a function of the initial progenitor mass. In the top panel, I show the depletion factors, and in the bottom panel, I show the ratio of the total dust mass divided by the initial stellar mass. What you see is that perinstability supernovae produce a large amount of dust. About 20-30% of the initial stellar mass can condense into solid dust grains, and the depletion factors, of course, are correspondingly higher. For type 2 supernovae, the answer depends very much on the initial metallicity of the progenitor stars and on the different energetics of the explosions, but generally we can see that the depletion factor can be as high as 20%, and that the total dust mass is always less than about 5% of the initial stellar mass. So you can have a contemporary formation, pollution of the surrounding gas with metals and dust in the universe. So when you consider this, well, you can ask the question, so what is the fragment mass of a second stellar generation, assuming that this is polluted by the explosion of very instability supernova or of a type 2 supernova? And of course, the answer depends on the metallicities, and you can rescale the different abundance ratios and the dust to metal abundance ratios for different metallicities. But what it is interesting to see is that the fragment mass shows in both cases two different branches. In the upper one, this is the fragmentation induced by line cooling, which is, of course, molecular line cooling for lower metallicities and oxygen and carbon line cooling for higher metallicities. And the lower branch is instead the fragmentation induced at much higher densities by dust cooling. And you see that in both cases, line-induced fragmentation scale is always larger than 70 solar masses. So it seems that with line cooling, you can never form really low or solar or subsolar fragments. Dust-induced fragmentation, instead, can lead to fragment masses, which are several orders of magnitude smaller. So it is really important to consider the effect of metals in dust grains when you consider the fragmentation properties of pre-stellar clouds. So how can we constrain this scenario? Well, the first thing to look at is the metallicity distribution function of the oldest stars present in the galaxy halo. And we know that so far no metal-free star has been found, and most of the stars have an iron over hydrogen ratio larger than -4.5, seems to indicate that there is a critical threshold for low-mass star formation. More recently, Chris Lieb and collaborators have observed a 0.8 solar mass star with a very low iron content. So is this meaning that you can form also low mass stars in the early universe or not? Well, this really depends on other two pieces of evidences. The first one is that this star has elements heavier than magnesium, meaning that this is a member of a second stellar generation. And the second is that this star is largely overabundant in carbon and nitrogen. And of course, whether or not the criterion for low mass star formation can be met depends on the origin of these two elements. And two different extreme assumptions can be made. In the first one, you can assume that the carbon and nitrogen were already present in the gas out of which the star has formed, and in this case, the metallicity of the cloud is as large as 10 to minus 2 solar. Well, in the opposite scenario, you can assume that carbon and nitrogen will form after the star has already been forming, and in this case, the metallicity of the pre-stellar cloud is much lower, but in both cases, as you can see, the metallicity is larger than the critical one, so the existence of this star is still consistent with the critical metallicity criterion. Now, to understand the cosmic relevance of population tree stars is very related to understanding how the process of metal enrichment occurs, and and depends very much on the strength of the chemical feedback. Chemical feedback means that the first stars explode and they pollute with metals and dust, the surrounding medium. So it depends on the metal yields and the energetics of the individual starbursts, which means that it depends on the efficiency of star formation and on the number of energetics of peri-instability supernovae, if these are the most important metal polluters early on. And then it depends on the properties of the supernova-driven outflows, so on the efficiency of wind generation and on how many metals are ejected and how efficiently are distributed among the outflows. And recently, we have developed with Evan Scannapieco a simple model which quantifies the chemical feedback strength by a single parameter, which is the energy per unit gas mass, and which depends on a combination of the above parameters. And with this model, we could estimate what is the relative contribution of POP3 and POP2 stars to the cosmic star formation rate. Here I show the star formation rate history as a function of redshift. The dashed line, red lines is the contribution of POP3 star, the solid blue lines the contribution of POP2 stars, and the different curves correspond to different chemical feedback strength, and the top and bottom panel assumes two different efficiency factors for POP3 formation. And in the left panels, right panel, I show the evolution, the corresponding evolution of the total metallicity of the universe. So as you can see, POP3 stars continues to contribute to star formation even at low redshift. They generally peaks, their star formation density peaks a redshift between 10 and 15, even if the average metallicities has overshoot the critical one much earlier. So the point here is that chemical feedback leads to a smooth IMF transition independent on the average value of the IGM, because it is very important to keep in mind that chemical feedback acts on a really local base, so you can really get wrong answers by considering average quantities. So how can we constrain the physics of this transition? Well, recently it has been pointed out that the near-infrared background provides one of the strongest indirect observational evidences for an early generation of very massive population tree stars. And indeed, several studies have shown that population tree stars can explain both the residual and fluctuations of the near-infrared background after the subtraction of the contribution of known galaxies. Here I show the fit provided to the near-infrared background by in a recent paper by Salvaterra and Ferrara, and the fit is can be reproduced provided that population tree stars were massive and that they give a negligible contribution to cosmic star formation below a redshift 9. So this redshift, the redshift at which population tree stars start to be really negligible in the universe, is very well constrained by the dropout in the J-band counts, and it is related to the redshifted Lyman-Alf emission for, from the end of this POP3 star formation epoch. So, as you can see, you have a strong constraint not only on the integrated amount of baryons which have been processed by POP3 stars, but also on the ending of the IMF transition. So why it is 9? We have to understand, if we believe to this near-infrared background interpretation, what is conspiring to extinguish this star at this redshift. So the first thing that we have considered was to understand whether chemical feedback starts to be particularly efficient at this redshift because of the hierarchy of mergers of dark matter halos. And in order to do that, we have used the Pinocchio code, which enables to produce random catalogs of dark matter halos and to reconstruct the hierarchical star formation, the hierarchical structure of structure formation. So here I show the properties of our reference simulation run. The box is 2.5 h minus 1 megaparsec moving, and the minimum dark matter halo that we can resolve have a mass of 10 to the 7 solar masses. The blue line here shows the minimum halo mass that is allowed to form stars, which we have adopted to be defined by the virial tempers of 10 to the 4 k, so there are only Lyman alpha cooling halos, and the black line here shows the mass of the largest object that we find in the simulation box at each redshift. So at each redshift, okay, so the resolution that we have chosen enables us to follow the formation of stars up to the highest redshift as soon as the mass gets larger than the threshold mass, and so it should be appropriate to address the issue of the IMF transition, which is the main focus of the analysis. So the different points here show the central values of the different mass bins in which we classify the halos at each redshift. And at each redshift, what you can do is to classify the existing halos which are enabled to form stars as POP2 or POP3 halos, depending on whether the halo itself or any of its progenitor have already experienced an episode of star formation. Clearly, this way of taking into account the chemical feedback is very conservative in a sense, because we are assuming that most of the metals that are left in the halo are enough to enrich the halo itself and any of its descendants to a metallicity level which enables the formation of low-mass stars. So, if we classify the halos as POP2 or POP3 halos with this criterion, this is what we find. These are the fraction of POP2 halos and fraction of POP3 halos as a function of mass for different redshifts. So what you see is that, as expected, the fraction of POP2 halos grows with mass and time, and the most of population 3 stars form in halos which have a total mass lower than 10 to the 9 solar masses. However, you see that you can have a significant fraction of POP3 halos even at redshift lower than 9, and in particular, you see that 75% of halos with masses around 10 to the 8 solar masses are POP3 halos at redshift 8, and also a residual 25% are still present at redshift 4. So, as expected, if you compute the star formation histories using this criterion, you end up with this answer. The dashed lines are the prediction of the Pinocchio code with chemical feedback. The red lines is the is population 3 contribution, and the green lines is population 2 contribution. Below redshift 20, we have completed our description with the star formation history predicted by the simulation of Charlie et al., because our simulation box is too small to describe the formation of objects with significant mass, larger than 10 to the 11 solar masses. And so what you can see is that you have a smooth transition, and you clearly expect that this will not be enough to reproduce the near-infrared background data. And in fact, here I show the data, the near-infrared background data, together with some data of the optical background here. This is the contribution of known galaxies, which has to be subtracted. And you see that population, if you fix the amplitude of this curve, that is the star formation efficiency, by requiring that it reproduce the near-infrared background counts, you overproduce the optical background. So clearly, the transition is not too fast. So far, we have completely neglected the effect of reionization in subsequent galaxy formation. And in particular, we know that the increase in temperature of the cosmic gas due to reionization can suppress the formation of low-mass galaxies with masses below the Jeans mass. And in order to quantify this photoionization feedback from reionization, we have adopted the filtering mass scale proposed by Knigg in 2000, below which we find that the gas content of the galaxies is reduced with respect to the universal value. And if we take into account this photoionization feedback, you see that below redshift 10, you have a decrease in the star formation rate by population 3 stars, and you have a much better agreement with both the near-infrared background data and the optical background data. So, to conclude, what we can understand from the near-infrared background is that if you believe to the interpretation that the residual amplitude is indeed due to the redshifted light from population 3 stars, then you have POP2 and POP3 stars coeval at redshift larger than 15, and that they give comparable contribution to the cosmic star formation rate. But then the contribution of POP3 stars drops below redshift 9 because of the joint effect of chemical feedback and photoionization feedback due to reionization. And the interesting implication for reionization are that reionization redshifts in the range between 8 and 10 are still within the error bars, but they require that the escape fraction from POP3 star is smaller than 5%. With these conditions, WMAP data can be reproduced. You have an optical depth for electron scattering between 0.14 and 0.15, depending on the different models. And however, double reionization, that is a non-monotonic increase of the ionized fraction, is very hard to achieve with this condition. You can have a marginal decrease of the ionized fraction between redshift 6 and redshift 9, but only if you assume that the escape fraction from pop 2 star is smaller than 3%, and you assume a clumping of the IgMM of 10. What is more plausible to achieve is an extended period of partial reionization that would be enough to kill the contribution of pop 3 star below redshift 9. It is very interesting that similar conclusions have been recently obtained in a paper by Furlanetto and Loeb, but starting from the point of view of trying to explain the feasibility, the physical feasibility of double reionization. So what I think is very interesting here is that very different observational evidences, that is the near-infrared background and the requirements of a double reionization history, seems to require the same kind of feedback which operates, that is chemical feedback and photoionizing feedback. So we're maybe on the good track to have a really self-consistent model. So now to get to the last point of my talk, I would like to show how we can have evidences of the chemical feedback by looking at the spectra of distant quasars. Here, first of all, we can try to see if it is possible to put some constraints on the on different regions of the stellar IMF by looking at the abundance ratios observed up to the highest redshift. Here I show a plot of the observed values here of iron over magnesium and of nitrogen over carbon. So these regions here indicate are rough indicators of the observed values. And we have compared, together with Aparna Venkatesan, values, these metal ratio values, with the prediction of chemical enrichment model assuming different stellar IMF. So the blue lines here assumes that pop 3 stars are very massive, whereas the red lines here show the prediction for stars forming with a sulfidar IMF, even if they have zero metallicity or solar metallicities. So what you see here is that if you assume three different burst turn on redshift, and then you evolved the enrichment model on the scale of the yields of each star, you have that you can reproduce the iron over magnesium ratio with all the three IMF, but you cannot reproduce the nitrogen over carbon ratio because with the very massive stars. And this depends on the fact that current stability supernovae severely underproduced nitrogen, so I don't know if this might change with future revision of the model or not. So the bottom line here is that the observed abundance ratios that you find in distant quasars seem to require the existence of a normal stellar population at redshift larger than 6. And however, we can understand this rather easily by considering that in the overdense regions, which are proved by quasars, we expect chemical feedback to be particularly strong and the IMF transition to have occurred early on. The same conclusions can be drawn by looking at dust properties in high redshift quasars. Recently, we have measured dust extinction in the spectra of the most distant global quasars at redshift 6.2. And what I show here is the observed spectrum in red, and as compared with, in blue, a non-Vulcan plate, that is a quasar which is not reddened by dust. So you see from this comparison that at wavelengths larger than 1,700 angstrom or so, this comparison seems to indicate that no dust is present. However, below this wavelength, you see that the observed spectrum is significantly reddened by dust. And if you compare this with the standard global spectrum at redshifts smaller than 4, you see that the kind of dust which produced this extinction must, of course, be different, because you see that the global quasars are much redder, they have a kind of flat slope here. So you can directly measure the extinction curve of dust using this equation here. And what I show here is the derived extinction curve from the observations, and the yellow region is the uncertainties associated with the different slopes of the intrinsic spectrum. The green line is the standard SMC extinction curve, which is responsible for the reddening of the global quasars at redshift lower than 4. You see that this cannot be explained by standard extinction. So trying to interpret these observations, we have considered the properties of dust produced in type 2 supernova explosions, and we have computed the predicted extinction law averaging over a Salpeter IMF. So what you see is that the supernova dust produce an extinction which is much closer to the observed value than the standard SMC curve. And this is very interesting because it's the first direct evidence that dust at redshift larger than 6 has been produced by supernovae, and it requires standard type 2 supernovae. It's not compatible with dust produced by perinstability supernovae. So again, we have an evidence that in quasars environments, it's very hard to look for traces of the first perinstability supernovae. So this is the summary of my talk. I've tried to give you some arguments of why we believe that metals in solid dust grains play a very important role in defining the critical conditions for low mass star formation. It seems that when you consider the self-consistent treatment of metals and dust in the first explosions, then line cooling never leads to really small fragments. And the cosmic effects of Pauperi star is very much related to the strength of chemical feedback, but we already have some important observational evidences through the near-infrared background, but also from the requirements of the observations of the reionization histories that can help us to really have some insights in the physics which controls the transition. And this has, of course, close connection with the reionization history. And finally, if you want to see chemical feedback in action, you just go and look at the at distant quasars, where you see that the enrichment history in both metals and dust require the existence of Pauperi 2 stars at redshift larger than 6. And I'll stop here.
Percent of their mass. That's better. Then you would expect a significant amount of the stellar radiation to be reprocessed into the far infrared. Have you taken that effect into account in your predictions for the near-infrared background? And does that predict a far infrared signature as well?
No, we haven't done it, but of course it's extremely important to do. It's extremely important to do, and actually we are planning to do that. But we haven't taken into account the effect of dust in the fit to the linear for our background. So this is not consistent in this way.
Yes, I have a question about the fragment mass. As you showed, with the presence of dust, you can get very small genes masses. The question is, if you have a small genes mass, does that mean that you'll actually get a fragment? So similarly, if you look at contemporary star formation, then as the collapse proceeds, and it's isothermal for a long time, but the density is going up, so the genes mass can get very small, but it doesn't mean that you form all the stars are 0.01 solar masses. So why is it that just because you have the small fragments, small genes mass, that you would get the small fragments in low mass stars?
Okay, this is extremely important, and it's a question that it's very hard to address with one zone semianalytic model, because of course they can have a very good handle on the chemical and thermal evolution, but they are poor in describing the dynamics of the fragments. What we see is that, recently Kazuyuki Omukai has developed a way of trying to describe the geometry of the clumps, and what it seems to be is that most of the cases, this kind of fragmentation is also dynamically important, and you really can't fragment. But of course, this it would be extremely important to confirm this by doing simulations of the process, maybe starting from the conditions that we have found with these semi-analytic models, and also with the maybe considering a simplified chemical evolution with the relevant cooling agents. So we still are working on that.
Question about the dust pool. So if I understand the characteristic mass of population 2, as you're calling it, is set by the dust cooling.
So is this going to be redshift dependent, because the fact the minimum temperature of the dust will be the microwave background temperature, and that's a lot higher at high redshift than it is at low redshift, or does this not play a role?
Well, I think that we have considered the temperature of the microwave background. I don't remember exactly when it starts to be relevant for dust, up to what redshift is relevant for dust. But what I see is that the typical fragmentation masses are between 0.01 and 0.3 solar masses, as predicted by this kind of mechanism. So I'm not sure, really. Of course, it depends on the relative temperature of dust grains and gas, so of course you are right. I don't remember exactly what is the effect of the temperature microwave background.
So what are the temperatures of the dust in the cooling regions that you're predicting?
You can see it from here, basically. So the cooling is start to be relevant up to when the cooling catches with the, when the grains catch with the temperature of the gas. Maybe it's easier if I do it. So, what you can see here is that the typical temperatures of this new minima that you have in the thermal evolution occurs between 200 and 800 K.
Okay, I guess it doesn't matter much.
Doesn't
matter.
You know, I was wondering one way to test your dust hypothesis. I'm assuming the dust is silicates. Am I correct about that?
Both graphites and silicates are forming.
Okay.
And also some magnetite.
All right, but you seem to have a lot of magnitudes of extinction. So one way to test that would be to look for the 9.7 micron feature, silicate feature. Have you thought about doing that? Because, yeah, of course. But with Spitzer, you could do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I couldn't tell from your graph, but you had 3 or 4 magnitudes of extinction. I couldn't tell from your.
Well,
you went by that.
I haven't computed it actually. What I showed was the total dust masses that we produce.
Yeah.
So what we are doing now, so far we have considered the extinction properties. Now we want to also, of course, convolve this information with the spectra and try to see if this alters the colors.
But I think that would be a good test to look for the discrete feature rather
definitely,
than just
yes.
Continuous opacity.
Regarding the near-infrared background and the question of the presence of dust, the effect of the presence of dust, affects the ability of Lyman alpha photons to make it out of the star-forming regions, not by the extinction of the Lyman alpha, but by the resonance scattering, which reduces the effective optical depth for destroying the Lyman alpha. Did you take that into account? Because I would have thought that before you were matching the near-infrared background, and I didn't see it go way down in the presence of dust, so I suspect you didn't have that in there. But go ahead.
Our approach to the near-infrared background was very empirical. I mean, we have this residual, and we want to interpret it. And a way of interpreting is by considering the contribution of Pottery stars. So far, we haven't considered the presence of dust. This is something which needs to be taken into account because we have worked out the dust properties later. But still, I think that if dust extinguished part of the Lyman alpha line emission, then what you see is that you may need more Pottery star contributing to explain these residual fluctuations. So in this way, we can be, I mean, thinking of placing a lower limit to the effect of Pottery stars in the near-infrared background.
dust. The dust is coming after the radiation of the first star, so you have the stars first, and eventually you have the supernova and the dust. So the radiation from first stars that goes into the background is always coming before, in any given galaxy, is coming before then.
Yeah, but
the
those
dust production.
Those which are emitting at redshift 9 may be affected.
In that case, you're always assuming that the
In order to make that statement, you're always assuming that the same galaxy only has one burst that lasts less than the supernova, the time to make a supernova. Okay.
Yes, I had a question about the assumptions that went into the model that produced star formation histories for both POP2 and POP3. What are you assuming about the chemical evolution inside a given halo? Is it a closed box model? Another way of asking the question is, can POP2 and POP3 stars form in the same halo, or they're segregated based on the chemical metallicity?
We have considered two different approaches to the problem. In the model with Evans Canapiego et al., what was done was to consider the outflows, so supernova-driven outflows, which are methyl-rich, and then we use two-point mass functions to estimate the probability that one halo was hit by the supernova-driven outflow emitted by a neighboring object. In the other kind of approach, we are considering a complementary aspect of chemical enrichment, that is, the fact that you have metals which are produced in a halo, and then, of course, the metals which are left inside the halos can affect the properties of the gas of the halos that you will later merge to. Okay? So there are two different approaches. In this second one, we always assume that the metallicity is enough to enable low mass star formation, the subsequent generation of galaxies. So in both cases, we either have a POP2 star forming site or a POP3 star forming site.
Yeah, I think the key point was that we're not forming a lot of stars in halos with virial temperatures below 10 to the 4. So if you assume that, that's relatively inefficient. So you form a few first stars and then you dissociate all the molecular H2. Then you get a very a long transition. And that's because Sedov-Taylor isn't so dependent on energy. So it's very hard to eject those metals so that they fill a large volume if you take a big mass. But if you say everything down to some very small virial temperature forms stars very efficiently, then you might change that conclusion.
So what halos form POP3 stars in redshift
9? They're mostly with virial temperatures right above 10 to the 4.
Late forming,
but from primordial gas. So they had no progenitors that have smaller mass.
This is consistent also with the other approach. We find the same answer with two different methods.
I had a question. I'm just a little confused, I'm afraid. What is your definition of dust, and what is your definition of population two? Is dust a certain set of elements, and is population two a metallicity or a mass? I mean, would a zero metal 50 solar mass star, what population would that be for you?
Okay.
And is oxygen equal to dust?
No, of course not. Okay, so dust means metals which are condensed into solid dust grains. So it's the standard definition of dust. You have different models which, starting from the late 80s, have investigated the formation of dust in supernova ejecta, and you have the condensation of these of metals into some critical clusters that then grow by accretion. So you have silicates, you have graphite grains.
There can be quite massive population 3 stars that by that definition make no dust. You know, a hundred solar mass star wouldn't necessarily make any.
100 solar mass dust will not, because it will not explode as a supernova. What we are considering is dust production in the ejecta of the supernova, not in the atmospheres of the stars.
And is population two, is that a metallicity or a mass statement?
it's both, because it's related. I mean, not population two. By population two, I mean stars which form with low masses because the metallicity has increased above a critical level.
But as we heard from Chris, stars might form down to 30 solar masses.
Yes.
With no metals. And I'd still call those population three. It's just, yeah. Maybe it's just...
Yeah, but it's a metallicity criterion, but of course you can have more generations of population three stars if they form with in gas which has a sufficiently low amount of metals and dust. Okay.
Yeah, a question on the near IR background. We have been told several times that anytime soon, or in the next few weeks, we'll get the second year WMAP results out. Suppose it comes out with a reionization redshift of 17 plus or minus 2, and I'm being optimistic. Would you say that then that rules out population 3 as the source of your near IR, because you were explaining the drop at Z equal 9 as due to reionization at Z equal 9. So if that's not confirmed by...
Okay, it depends on how you describe the photoionization feedback, of course. So if it is very strong and essentially you kill the contribution of all low-mass galaxies from that point on, then of course, yes, you have some problems because you will have the dropout too early. But if not, if at that redshift the photoionization feedback is not that strong, then maybe you can still have some residual contribution. It really depends on the mass scale below which you can really suppress star formation in these objects.
So you can still readjust that mass scale
to fit?
I don't know. Maybe.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Rafaela. So we close for the morning. We thank you. Thank you there.